Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
In an effort to clear the existing backlog of solar, wind, and battery projects seeking to be built, the Energy Department has created a new roadmap with some ways to get them connected to the nation's grid faster. It's called the Transmission Interconnection Roadmap, and DOE hopes it will help it hit targets for interconnection improvement by 2030. To learn more about this tool, I speak to Becca Jones-Albertus, who is director of DOE's Solar Energy Technologies Office. Becca, thank you so much for taking the time.
Great to be here, Eric.
So why don't we just start with an overview of what this interconnection roadmap is and just sort of how it all came together, and then we can kind of get into the mission of it.
At the Department of Energy, we are focused on how we can enable the president's goal of decarbonizing our electricity grid by 2035. To get there, we need to rapidly increase the amount of solar, wind, and battery storage that we are deploying. One of the barriers we need to overcome to accelerate that deployment is interconnection. Interconnection, along with siting of projects, supply chain challenges, those are some of the biggest challenges to be overcome to enable greater solar, wind, and energy storage deployments. Specific to interconnection, we have seen a substantial rise in the number of projects that are submitting applications to grid operators to interconnect to the grid in recent years. And we've seen the backlog of those projects growing tremendously. And so while it used to take just a couple of years to get through an interconnection queue, we're now seeing projects on average taking 5 years to come out of queues. We now have as much solar and energy storage in the interconnection queues as we would need to deploy over the next decade to get to our clean energy goals. But at the same time, we're seeing that less than 20% of the projects that enter those queues are being built. So we're seeing a problem that's kind of exacerbating year over year, where there's more projects going into the queues slowing down, and then there's less information about which projects will be viable at the end of that process. And so then more projects are put into the queue, and we continue to exacerbate that problem. So this is a major issue that we've been focused on addressing at DOE. And as one of the major pillars of that work, we developed this interconnection roadmap. So we have a larger effort that's called the Interconnection Innovation Exchange, or I2X, which is bringing together stakeholders to address the challenges related to interconnection to get to fairer, simpler, and more equitable practices. And that effort has been a large stakeholder group. And one of the big pillars has been this roadmap. And so over a nearly 2 year process, since we launched the I2X program, we've been working to develop the roadmap, held 22 meetings with stakeholders, got feedback from more than 2,000 participants on the challenges that need to be solved, pathways of solving those challenges. And the result is a roadmap that we hope can be an integrated solution set for DOE to use in its funding opportunities for industry and other stakeholder groups to use as well in targeting their efforts to improve interconnection processes.
All right. And forgive me for making us back up even more. Interconnection, that means that the technology is there to generate power, but this is the process of actually connecting it to the power supply.
The interconnection process is what the name of the process is called, where a new power plant gets permission from the grid to connect to the grid and to provide power into the grid. And so what has to happen on the grid side is that they have to ensure that that particular location can handle that influx of power coming onto the grid, that it can do so in a safe way, and that involves studying what will happen to the grid if you add that power, and studying whether there's new equipment needed onto the grid, which we often can call upgrades. If there are upgrades, what do those cost? Are they cost prohibitive or not? It studies how that additional power that comes on the grid might contribute to congestion or might influence adjacent areas. So there's a number of engineering studies that need to be done to determine whether a particular location is viable for generating a bunch of power and putting it on the grid.
Gotcha. All right. So it seems as if the current situation might be, you know, a good problem to have. You've got all this power and infrastructure ready to go. It's just the actual case of getting it started up. You laid out some of the challenges. Is it just more of a fact of you don't have everything you need and that's the reason for the backlog? Or is there just sort of a log jam of just how long it takes to get something implemented into it?
there's a logjam of how long it takes to get through these processes. The models and methods that currently exist today for evaluating the addition of new generation or storage on the grid are not suitable for the volumes that we have. So, you know, we're looking at how can we develop better tools and models to make some of this process more automated and faster. Another source of problem is that today, the developers who are putting these power projects together, they don't really have any visibility into what locations are good for the grid. And so they end up using the interconnection process to pare down their projects. So they might be looking at five different sites for building a project, and they're not sure which one will be cost effective to put onto the grid, because they don't have a way to get that information. So they submit all five into the queue, even though they're only intending to build one. And so that whole evaluation process has to go through for all five of those projects.
Just to be told no.
Yes, it's very inefficient. And so another one of the goals is to find ways that grid operators can put this information out there so that they don't have to go through their whole evaluation process in order for developers to know whether or not a location is good. And that can cut down on the volume a lot, too.
Gotcha. We're speaking with Becca Jones-Albertus, who is director of the Energy Department's Solar Energy Technologies Office. And so let's get into the actual roadmap itself. I imagine what you just described is in there as well for reducing the amount of time it takes for interconnection. What are some of the other tools that are laid out in there for developers to consult as they are trying to develop new projects for clean energy?
So the roadmap we've put together, we want to be a roadmap for all the stakeholder groups. So that's grid operators, that's project developers, that's community organizations, that's the federal government, that's others developing solutions. And so it has solutions that are relevant for all of those groups. And then we have a set of funding at DOE that we are putting together that will address some of those targeted solutions. And then other groups may be addressing other solutions. But the roadmap is founded on collecting better data and information, which can help reduce what goes into the queue, improving the processes of evaluating projects in the queue itself, and addressing major barriers, like how when you find out that the grid needs to be what we call upgraded, they need to add expensive new equipment, how those costs can be shared in a way that still enables projects to go forward. So sometimes today it's just the first project that would trigger that need that would have to pay the millions of dollars, even though many projects would benefit from that. And so helping establish some processes for what's called cost allocation are another aspect or type of solution in the roadmap.
The goal is interconnection improvement by 2030. What exactly does that mean? And does that just mean a great reduction of the backlog or, you know, a smoother transition for folks trying to get connected? What did you all have in mind when setting that goal?
We have set a number of quantitative goals, but basically we want the process to be faster. We want more of the projects that go into the process to result in real projects that go onto the grid. And we want there to be a lot more certainty and understanding of how much it will cost to interconnect the grid.
Gotcha. And so will this be something that is continuously updated, or is this going to be the end-all be-all Bible for anyone trying to develop a new project?
We think this will be a good document to guide efforts over the next several years. Hopefully at that point, we'll find we're making a lot of progress and we'll need an updated document with maybe a smaller number of actions to enable our clean energy goals and get to faster, simpler, and fairer interconnection processes. But we'll have to see how much work we can get done over the next couple of years.
Becca Jones-Albertus is director of the Energy Department's Solar Energy Technologies Office. And once again, thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Eric.
And you can find this interview along with a link to more information at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Kolmstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion. And then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there taking notes on the meeting and said, go ahead and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way. And I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions. expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going, because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.